sets of slides to show you tonight from South Asia, Bangladesh, India, and Sri Lanka, formerly known as Ceylon. I will run a set of about 50 first, and then Paul Hansen will follow with a similar collection that he has from his time in India and Sri Lanka. I was in Bangladesh and India last fall for about three and a half weeks, with a Lutheran World Relief team visiting development work in those two countries, which we support as U.S. Lutherans through Lutheran World Relief. LWR, as you may know, is the U.S. International Development Agency. Despite its name, it does a lot more with development than with emergency relief. I want to say an introductory word about the presence of the international church community in those two countries, Bangladesh and India. Along with a few other places in the world today, they are countries where it is not possible for foreign church personnel openly to preach the gospel, to do evangelization. That work is left for the indigenous churches to do. And that, I think, is just fine, because often the indigenous Christians have far more credibility in the proclamation of the gospel message than do foreign missionaries. But that leaves the foreign church personnel with basically one thing to do, and that is human development work. Healthcare, education, literacy training, and a lot of rural development, a lot of agricultural work, because the food situation is a major problem in both countries. I think we need to look at that as doing the gospel. When the gospel cannot be spoken verbally by international church personnel, there is still a role for us, for them, to do the gospel in deeds, to act out the grace, the gracious attitude of God toward people. And I think that's what's going on, and that is how we should view it. And then when people ask, as they inevitably do, why oceanic storms, typhoons, hurricanes? Water is a problem, a curse, and a blessing for the people of Bangladesh. It is what sustains 110 million people there. When everything is working right, they can survive. And they get three rice crops a year. They're planting and growing rice all the time. They also benefit from centuries, millennia of silting brought by the river systems that flow through on the way to the Indian Ocean. This is a typical scene of a fishing boat on the water of Bangladesh. Most of the goods and people in Bangladesh move by water. They have twice as many kilometers of waterway as they do of roadway. This is in the city of Dhaka, the capital, where there are ferries going back and forth all throughout the day and night, carrying people across the river from one bank to the other. When you come to a river in Bangladesh, when you're traveling on a road, you get off. You get off the roadway because there are almost no bridges. Bridges are expensive to build and the rivers are very wide, and you get on a ferry boat, as these people on buses were doing. And everything, including livestock, moves by ferry across the rivers. On top of those buses are jute containers full of live chickens on the way to market. Fruit also moves by water and boat. These are pineapples coming into market in Dhaka. Now we're in the northwest in the Rangpur Dinajpur region, where the Lutheran World Federation has the largest development project in the whole country that is non-governmental. It's a $4.5 million U.S. Annual budget, employing 1,800 people, mostly Bangladeshis. This young man is fishing in one of the waterways of that region. This one was carrying earth, or they look like rocks, to rebuild the dikes that were washed away by last summer's flooding. And here is one of those rebuilt dikes with a roadway on top of it. The water they try to control with a system of dikes and dams, and without a great deal of success. The reason the flooding is getting worse and more prevalent is apparently because the forests in the highlands to the north of Bangladesh, in India and Nepal, have been denuded by poor people living there who need the fuel. And what used to hold the water back as it rushed down to the sea no longer does. This woman was planting young trees on the bank to try to keep the bank from washing away the next time the flooding comes. A lot of the agriculture in Bangladesh is the water on the surface, which isn't there half of the year during the dry season, is supplemented by this kind of a very basic technology pump system. It's a treadle pump operated by human power. Man stands on there hours at a time with his feet going up and down, pumping up water for the rice. Typical rice paddy in northern Bangladesh. Our group of three, Timon, Strack, and Lutz, were welcome to one of the villages that we visited. And we liked the way they spelled welcome. RDRS is Rangpur Dinajpur Rural Service. That is the name of the development project that Lutheran World Federation operates in this corner of the country, which has about one-tenth of the population of Bangladesh, about 10 million people. And it's a comprehensive rural development project which was launched shortly after independence came to Bangladesh in 1971. LWF had been there assisting the refugees during the time of the Civil War when Bangladesh broke away from the rest of Pakistan and became an independent nation. After the war was over, the Bangladesh people asked LWF to stay on and help them with long-term development. A large area of the work is adult literacy training, primarily for women, because women, as is typical in some other chiefly Muslim countries, do not get much education. It is not part of the culture for women to go to school. And so these women are learning to read and write for the first time as adults. We visited villages, and in this village, a young mother with a child less than a week old, we were told, brought out to us and proudly presented to us her young infant. We also visited a hospital called LAM, Lutheran Aid to Medicine in Bangladesh. It is supported by and really now sponsored by World Mission Prayer League, which is an independent Lutheran mission based in the Twin Cities of Minnesota, but with supporters from all around the world, primarily Scandinavian Lutheran in origin. The woman on the right is the chief physician there, and her presence characterizes the reality of international development work in the church. She is a Church of Scotland person from Aberdeen in Scotland who is working in a Lutheran hospital in Bangladesh in South Asia. Talking with a young mother whose child is malnourished and is back for their young child clinic, where the mothers come and live with the children while the children are built up nutritionally so that they can go back and, it is hoped, survive in their own villages. This is the chapel at LAM Hospital in the northern part of Bangladesh. It is built, as the plaque on the wall says, with gifts from Calvary Lutheran Church of Golden Valley, Minnesota, a Twin Cities suburb. And it was given as a in memory of a person from that congregation who had died, and friends and relatives contributed the money for this little chapel. Now, some typical scenes also from Bangladesh of rural community life. A woman spreading rice straw in the sun to dry, and it'll be used for thatching, probably in roof work in houses, possibly in making the mortar for the mud walls of houses. And a traditional plowing scene with a single wooden blade and two bullocks pulling the plow. Young girls, young women in Bangladesh, as in most of the developing world, are responsible for carrying water from a surface water supply somewhere to the village. And that's what these two young women are doing with their traditional earthen vessels. Very different scene. the residence of the U.S. ambassador to Bangladesh in Dhaka, Ambassador Dupre in the center. On the left is Jean Tiemann, the LWR person responsible for this part of the world in the New York office, and myself on the right. Now, switch gears a little bit, not too many miles away, to Calcutta, which is in India, but close to the Bangladesh border. And the sister here is in the habit of a fairly well-known order now around the world, the Missionaries of Charity. I'm sure some of you recognize that habit. Who do you associate with that habit? Mother Teresa, exactly. This is one of Mother Teresa's institutions in Calcutta, of which there are many, serving the poorest of the poor, the people nobody else wants to care for. This one, I think, was an institution for tuberculosis patients. They were stacking and wrapping newspapers for recycling as a way of earning a little bit of money for the institution. Here we had a cottage industry in a very low-income part of Calcutta. People were earning a living by painting, in this instance, Lakshmi goddesses for a Hindu festival that was coming up. Had no religious significance for these people. They were going to make a little bit of money by selling these on the street. And it happened to be a project that was supported by Lutheran World Relief. And I thought of the irony of U.S. World Hunger dollars going to help paint Lakshmi goddesses in Calcutta. The importance of it, of course, was economic. It provided income for these people. In the north of Bihar State, north of Calcutta by train, an overnight train ride, we visited the Paharia Development Project. The Paharias are tribals. Those are, we would say, the native, they are like the Native Americans. They are the native or original indigenous people of that part of India before the later arrivals came in and took over. They are the least developed, the least advanced, and there's a lot of development work being done there. Every village of theirs we visited welcomed us with this kind of a gateway and a ribbon to be broken, and there were dancing young men and girls with drums and dance lines, and we had to go through that little gate to be formally welcomed. And here's a line of the girls who danced to welcome us. And then they washed our feet, an experience I'd never had before, and it had almost a New Testament feel about it. But we also decided if we were going to do this regularly, we'd wear sandals rather than tennis shoes that had to be tied and untied. But that was their way of showing hospitality, along with giving us these floral lei-like arrangements that we put around our neck. And those were fresh flowers. They were made that day for us. Part of the development activity is to educate people, and this poster had to do with the major problem they have with moneylenders who come in and tell the people when they're out of cash and out of grain, don't worry, I'll solve your problem. My intentions are pure. And of course, this is a very sarcastic poster because they charge the people 100% interest. And they're trying to break the hold of the moneylenders by creating co-ops and credit unions among the poor and then warning them not to patronize the moneylenders. This sign, this poster, was in two languages, the local language, which I think was Bengali, and English. And you can read some of it, I think. Let us unite for self-sufficiency. The English is not always completely accurate. Grow grain, save grain. These are almost like bumper sticker slogans that they use to teach the people. Let us explore the optimum government resources, take advantage of what is available. There are a lot of programs available that people either don't know about or they're too timid to apply for. No more thumbprint. That's a reference to the symbol of the thumbprint, which represents illiteracy. That's a way of saying let's stamp out illiteracy. And then finally, don't drink for child's sake. In many of these rural communities, alcoholism is a major problem. Woman was cracking larger rocks into smaller rock for road gravel. Very laborious work, but the people were happy to have the work because it meant a few rupees a day of income. They sit there hours at a time doing that work. This is a trench around a reforestation area to the right, in which the young trees and seedlings were being protected from wild animals and even domestic livestock by a trench, which they said worked better than a fence. Now down in the south of India, in Kerala state, Kerala is the most Christian part of India. It's 20% Christian. No other state of India has anything close to that in percentage. It's also had Christianity the longest, at least since the 4th century, and some of the Christian traditions there claim to go back to the 1st century and the Apostle Thomas. One of the Orthodox churches in Kerala is called the Martoma Church. So you see a lot of churches and crosses in Kerala, much more than in other parts of India. You also see symbols of Marxism, because the current government of Kerala and the government elected for most of the years since independence in 1947 has been Marxist. But they go back and forth between Marxist and non-Marxist governments. As one of the people told us, we don't want any of them to be in office too long, because you can't trust them if they're in office too long. So they keep changing. But here Marxists are elected by the people in democratic elections. And there was a Marxist rally going on in this city when we were there, and so you have a picture of Karl Marx. Seems a little out of place in the south of India, but there he is. The priest on the right in white is a Syrian Orthodox priest who's working for a development project assisted by Lutheran World Relief, and he took us to visit this school. Another project assisted by LWR is the Tropical Health Foundation of India in Kerala, and these are tropical or village health workers who have a little bit of medical training. They are not physicians, but they go out and do basic and primary health training in the villages around this central clinic. Here they were proudly showing us where their uniforms are made. And the making of their uniforms provides employment for seamstresses. We were taking a break in Kerala, three of us with various sized tummies, obviously affluent North Americans. They gave us freshly cut coconuts to drink milk from. In Jamked, east of Bombay in Maharashtra state, there is a major rural health project that has been supported by church money from all over the world, including U.S. Lutheran dollars. The doctors are two Indian doctors who are Christians, Raj and Maybel Aroli, on the left and the right in this photo. This is a picture in their clinic. I took it mainly to show the quilt, which came from North America, probably from one of your congregations, through Lutheran World Relief. Dr. Maybel was showing us the eye chart in their clinic, which had four sides to it. On the back were English and Hindi. And on the left is Maharashtra, and on the right is the language they use for illiterates. This is one of their village health workers showing us the visual aid she uses to teach people in the villages about health care, preventive health care. And here's the weighing device she uses to record the birth weight of newborn babies and for the first 5 years of life. Cotton spinning is a part of their operation at Jamked. Nearby is a goat husbandry activity that is also part of their development project. Now a few shots that are more general. This is a Jain temple in Bombay. The Jains are a kind of sect of Hinduism, an offshoot, and they have an absolute reverence for life, so that they refuse, as did Albert Schweitzer, even to step on an insect if they can avoid it. And one of the persons who was worshiping in this temple had on what is fairly common among the Jains, a mask over the nose and mouth. That's to avoid accidentally ingesting any kind of insect, which would be a violation of their faith. Gandhi is remembered in India in museums in various places. I'm not sure Gandhi is that much a part of current politics in India, but the museums are there. This is a statue of Gandhi outside the museum in New Delhi. Inside, I took this picture because it was a display on civil, nonviolent social change around the world. And in the lower right corner, you'll recognize, I think, a picture from the U.S. Civil Rights Movement in the 60s, Martin Luther King in the center of the second row, and in the foreground, Andy Young, who was one of his young lieutenants at that time. The house in Bombay, where Gandhi lived in the 20s after he came back from South Africa, and as he was beginning to write about and plan for the movement that led to the independence of India. Now, I'll conclude with some more water scenes, these from India. In 1987, there was serious drought in many parts of India. The Churches of India, the Churches Auxiliary for Social Action, which is an ecumenical social development agency for the churches there, decided they would seek money from international partner agencies, such as Lutheran World Relief, to dig 2,000 deep wells in the most drought-prone areas of those six states. This is one of those wells. The wells have been dug. It's a project called Water for Tomorrow. And whereas people used to have to go out to surface supplies that were unreliable and unsafe and dried up part of the year, they now, in their villages, have, in these 2,000 locations, deep wells with dependable water supply that is safe and does not have to be carried a couple kilometers. This woman at the well, at the pump, was showing us with great pride the well that was just a few yards from her back door. And she talked with us through an interpreter very joyfully about the revolutionary change in her life that having the well and the water there meant to her. This woman used to carry in that earthen vessel water from a surface supply, and now she gets it at the well. And this child happily drinking the fresh, cold, safe water from the well. One of the people who was with us that day, a development worker for the Churches of India, said, "All development work begins with water, with a safe and dependable supply of water, whether it's for human consumption or for irrigation on thirsty fields." And I guess that's the theme that struck me as we were in Bangladesh and India, the importance of water, which we take so much for granted in most of this continent. That's the end of the slides of that set. Well, we can take a few questions now if you have them, and then I'll hand the mic and the operation here to Paul, and he can go into his set. Are there any questions about any of this before we go on? All right, if not, we'll go to the second set, and then maybe at the end we'll have a little time for conversation.
I was kind of a late add-on addition to this when I found out Chuck had been in India and was doing a program here. I did happen to have a few slides along. Most of my slides are on Sri Lanka, the ones that I brought. I have about 2,000 slides of India, and fortunately for you, I didn't bring those with me. But I've been in India at various times over the last 20 years, a couple of times for stays of about a year, and I've traveled around fairly extensively, and I thought what I could do to perhaps supplement the things that Chuck has shown you is give you, though not a direct picture of development work as such, some more about the context in which this work is done, and some of the conditions of ordinary people's existence that point out the need for such work. So anyway, this will give you also some indication of the tremendous variety that you have in India. We think of India as a country. I always tell people to think of it as a continent, at least as a subcontinent, which it is, and very analogous to Europe, both in terms of population and in terms of linguistic and ethnic diversity. And you'll see a little bit of that in the slides anyway. So if we could start those. I thought I'd begin with a slide that would confirm some of your stereotypes before I hope I change them a little bit. But this shows, in a typical North Indian street, a couple of themes that you may well associate with India. The wandering homeless cow. Cows are turned out after they cease to be productive. And because they won't be killed, in many cases you'll find cows that are operated as scavengers in the street and essentially are like stray dogs. They are not necessarily revered in the sense that people want anything more to do with them than they do with stray dogs, but they are not killed. The other thing that you see is one of the important products of the cow on the wall. Cow dung. Cow dung is widely used, especially in the Indo-Gangetic Plain, primarily as a fuel, because fuel in the form of wood is very scarce, and in the form of fossil fuels is too expensive, so this is what is used. It's widely available. Children have as one of their tasks usually going out and scouring the roads for any that's available, but it of course means that the same stuff cannot be used as fertilizer, which is another important problem. One last thing up there is a movie poster, and some of you may know that India has the world's largest film industry. It is something that every Indian of whatever class and stripe passionately enjoys, the Indian cinema. The Indian movie stars are probably the biggest celebrities in the subcontinent, and some of them now, in following in trends that we've seen elsewhere, are being elected to high office. There are a couple of them. There are a couple of them who are state ministers in India and have parlayed their film careers into successful political careers as well. Again, my slides will also point out some of the widespread use of human labor in India for many kinds of tasks, including simple movement of goods from place to place in the bazaars. And in city life, which is even more overcrowded than rural life in many respects, people do not wait to acquire a store in a mall. If you want to go into business for yourself, stake out a patch on the pavement. And large bazaars, in fact, are available to you in the markets just by walking up and down the streets. Sometimes interesting conglomerations of plastic beads or seashells. Virtually any commodity has resale value as well. I know a bazaar in Delhi where you can buy old nails, used nails, empty Coke bottles, all things are recycled in India. Long before we got the message here at Holden or elsewhere, the people in India have always been recycling everything. If you hire a sweeper to sweep out your house and you have trash baskets, that's one of the perks, is he gets to go through the trash baskets and take anything that can be resold. You can see some Indian versions of Foster Grants there on the top. Not moving real rapidly right now. I don't see a lot of Indians in sunglasses, but this guy apparently had eternal hope that someone would buy this. Some of the things you see for sale, you have to be a little inquisitive to find out what they're about or be there long enough. These women are buying threads, very colorful threads, to tie on the arms of their brothers, because this is a holiday in Western India in which the brother-sister relationship is celebrated and solidified by that as part of a particular ritual. Another example of some interesting things you see in various markets. This is a part of the iron workers market, and what they're selling there in the foreground are bird cages, including some with parrots already in them. But then you can get, if you wondered about our over-packaging, I mean, here you can buy one nut, one nail, one screw of any particular size in the little bins and compartments that these people have. And if they don't have one or that you want, they'll make it to order. Sugarcane, other kinds of things that you don't ordinarily see on the produce market are, of course, widely available in tropical countries like India. The wholesale market in bananas. And your friendly neighborhood, Kentucky Fried. Most meat, which is not widely available, is either sold to by and from untouchables or Muslims who do the butchering. At least the upper class Hindus. That's one of the indications of caste status, is if you're the degree to which you can be particular about your diet up to the top. This is a cloth market in Delhi, and one of the external signs that you learn to read after a while are headgear. This would indicate that these men are Muslims. Again, some snacks, peanuts, and other grains being sold with a hand scale. Services are also widely available on the streets. The pharmacy is open here. There is a long tradition of herbal medicine in India called Ayurvedic medicine, and that's what this man is selling. He's got all the text to look up whatever your ailment is, and then he can grind some of the stuff into powders that will cure you. In a lot of ways, there are some similarities to traditional Chinese medicine, in which many of these are quite valid remedies. They work very well. You don't stay in business if you don't get some result. Another service available on the street, dental care. Operating with his complete set of equipment. We don't have a lot of sterilization here, but if your mouth happens to fit two or three of the dentures he has available there, you're in good shape. Again, the stress on manual labor and the fact that in many cases this is advantageous to the local economy to be labor intensive when, in fact, as Chuck mentioned, many people need jobs of various kinds, but most of us haven't seen coal yards for a long time, and the coal being chopped into smaller pieces and moved by hand is a certainly very dirty and filthy job. And a very labor-intensive one, filled into sacks like those that you see in the carts back there and then hand-delivered to people for your bag of coal, or by head, as the person in the foreground is doing. Another industry, particularly in central India, in Maharashtra, around the area Chuck was mentioning, is cotton. And this is right after the cotton harvest. They use cotton harvesting machines here. They're not all picked by hand anymore, though some of that also takes place. It's still a largely labor-intensive process, as it used to be in the American South, though I wouldn't make all the same analogies there. One of the other ways of making a living is to go to the city and get into some of the manufacturing processes. This is a cloth textile dyeing plant in Ahmedabad in Gujarat in western India, and with the complete lack of OSHA-style regulations in India, no one looks at working conditions at all. In many cases, as the Bhopal tragedy pointed out, many industrial workers in India work in highly dangerous and toxic situations. These workers stand all day in the dyes, the chemical dyes, dyeing the clothes in the vats with no protection at all, or in the bleaching pits, which are, you know, how hard bleach is on your hands and so forth, but that's where they are. Then these beautiful Indian textiles hung up to dry in these racks, but the juxtaposition with the squatters' working quarters there that are right adjacent to their place of work, put together with whatever corrugated pieces of iron and cardboard and other things that they've found. So you'll see these kind of squatter slums, which are endemic in all the world, third world cities in most of the large urban areas in South Asia. Another indication of what a squatter's life is like, this is a dairy man. He happens to be living in Delhi. He's got a couple of water buffalo, which he milks for each morning to go out and sell. And most of his space here is taken over to the feeding of his animals, including some of the silage that he has gathered in the foreground. And his own living quarters are simply this little lean-to here in the corner. Another compound that indicates a family here, the men who are out working, whatever it is, there is the woman's kitchen in the back under that with that little earthen stove. She's preparing a variety of dishes. The laundry is out there. The beds are stacked right here on the left. All the space is cleared away, and then those two beds would be put down at night, and that's where people would sleep. This man's doing a little plaster repair. It's a mud wall with whitewash on it. He's doing a little plaster repair on the wall of his shop. The importance of clean water has been mentioned because, of course, water is so important for many things, including laundry. This is the local laundromat. Those rocks are placed there in the river, and washermen called dobies will come down and wash the clothes in the river, which of course also usually has to be used for drinking water, etc. Then you see the man up above, and what's he washing? Can you see clearly? He's washing a goat in the same water, and this is one of the continual problems, the clean water supplies. Here's a washerman with his finishing equipment. This is a professional laundryman, and you can see his iron there. Iron in which he heats up a couple of coals and drops them on the top, and that's something perhaps you haven't seen except in a museum. I've seen many of them in operation in India. Here you have tea plantations. Everything all the way up the side of all the hills are tea plantations. These happen to be in Sri Lanka. You'll find similar fields in the north of India. Most of the tea is picked by women. In Sri Lanka, they happen to be Tamil immigrants, and many of them are Christian. They muster early in the morning. They work in work gangs, and then bring in their quotas and get them weighed to see if they've done enough tea picking for the day. Another crop is rubber. Here you can see tapping into the rubber tree, again gathered mainly by women. You can see the ring here that's cut into the tree where the latex, the sap comes down, and then it's collected by women in buckets.
Sri Lanka.
It's in Sri Lanka. This is in the south of India and in Sri Lanka. Coconut is an important crop, not just for refreshing travelers like Chuck, but for a variety of uses, including the external part of the coconut, which is used to create rope, which is what they're doing here, bringing that out from a spinning machine like this. And another of the industries around the coconut is toddy tapping. Guys have their ropes strung up among the trees, and they go from place to place tapping into to get the toddy that they will make into a very potent alcoholic beverage, which is the equivalent of moonshine. In those places, it's not legal, but it's an industry that's well long established in those areas. These seacoasts like this in South India look like paradise, but the economic conditions are very hard. You oftentimes don't have any viable agricultural land nearby. The one possible way of making a living is making lime for cement. But that's done by going out and dismantling the coral reefs, which are offshore. And so it's discouraged by the government, but this coral that's piled here on the left is nevertheless done. This is done in these kilns because people don't have any economic alternative. Although it's technically illegal to go out and take this coral, you'll see it being done because people have no alternative. But fishing, of course, is a major means of subsistence along the coast. This type of fish net is for tidal fishing off the Kerala coast. Sometimes net fishing in inland bodies of water as well as on the coast from boats. This fishing village on the east coast of India demonstrates another form of ocean fishing. The boats are too large and heavy to carry up in one piece, so they've designed these boats so that they come apart in sections. They can take them down to the surf line, put the boats together, and then when they come back out, disassemble the boats like this and take them up in pieces. Sometimes the catch is relatively meager because these waters have been fished for a very long time by a lot of people and these boats can't get too far out to sea. But sometimes you come up with something good, something big, and generally the division of labor is that the men catch the fish, the women market them. At festival time, which is almost every time in India, I mean, India is technically a secular state, but which simply means that it celebrates all religions, not that it has none. This particular festival, very common, is the selling of colored powders and dyes is used in many festivals, and you can see what's available in the market here. This particular festival is in Mysore State. In the beginning of the year, this is the cow I always say that gives buttermilk, but it's really a festival in which you paint up your cows and celebrate the important role that the cows play in your life economically. The cows get garlanded, they get decorated, paraded around. You can see you really get the first class treatment. Flowers are often a sign not only of hospitality and greeting, but of course are used extensively in worship. And you will see bazaars in which flowers are sold everywhere near temples. That's a common offering along with food. So when you go to a temple or someplace to worship, this statue is not a statue of a cow. It's the bull Nandi, which is a representative, emblematic of the god Shiva. Shiva has a vehicle. He rides on the bull. And so this bull has the markings of Shiva. But you can see the size of this. This dates from about the early 17th century. It's about 15 feet high. You can see the man in the foreground there worshiping at the place. And a couple just quick slides. I decided to go very easy on Indian temples to go easy on you. But here's one of the more famous temples in South India, in Madurai. A typical style in South India is to build these massive gateways. This is a whole temple complex between the gateways, the low, flat, roofed area. But if you look more closely at these gateways, these are huge gateways filled with painted sculptures of, well, you have an entire Hindu mythology on the gateways with representations of the gods and goddesses in various forms, which sort of takes your breath away when you look at it up close. The hope of South Asia, as well as its concern, are certainly its children, and probably that's the best way to end, is with a few looks at some of the children. And we'll leave it there. Okay, we can have the lights now.
Let me just say one word that I didn't give you on the economy of the two countries. Bangladesh is one of the four or five poorest countries in the world in terms of per capita annual product. India is twice as well off as Bangladesh. And when you travel from Bangladesh to India, you sense that. You see the difference. Even though India is very poor, Bangladesh is much poorer. India also has within it a wealthy nation of about 10% of its population, a rich nation by anyone's standards, including the most affluent countries in the world. That's a nation of 80 million people who are very rich and very high-consuming people. So we all countries do. You want to say anything about economics? What about Sri Lanka? Kerala, by the way, is the wealthiest part of India, the most advanced, the most educated, and the most Christian, and it also has a Marxist government. I don't know how that all fits together, but that's part of the reality.
Yeah, probably part of the connection is it's also the highest rate of literacy in that, and best educated. As Chuck was mentioning, the economy of India is such that statistics can play lots of games with you. When you talk about statistics of India on the aggregate, then India appears in the top 10 everywhere. It's one of the it's got most miles of railroad track. It produces more steel. It has all of these things. Of course, the big factor in India is population. So whenever you divide per capita figures out, then India appears at the bottom of various tables. But as Chuck says, it tends to make it difficult to get a fix on what India is. It consists of many different nations, and the different regions of India vary very dramatically in their prosperity, as he was hinting at there as well. Again, I get back to the opening comment, which is that India is much more like Europe, in which it's very difficult for you to generalize about Europe. People in a Portuguese village versus people living in Munich live at different standards of living as well. And although they're even more extreme in India, there are the same kinds of things that are occurring there. As far as population control is concerned, which is a question that people often raise about India and South Asia in general, there has been for some time efforts made at population control. It's not something that has actively been discouraged by the government. You'll see the billboards all over, and they have been up for over 25 years. But the realities of the situation are, of course, that without any kind of social welfare net to preserve and help people, children are your best insurance in your old age. They are generally assets to the family instead of deficits economically, in that they can do many of these kinds of labor-intensive jobs and bring something in. The one cultural thing that I would say that continues to push population up would be there still is a very strong preference for having at least one male child, which tends, even in educated families, to keep trying until that happens. And the other thing, of course, that will dramatically affect this, besides raising the standards of living of people, will be the adult literacy program for women that was highlighted in the slides, too. And that's something that is much farther along in India than it is in Bangladesh, but that's another important factor. The Indian approach has always been, though, because it is a democracy, it is one in which the basic freedoms are protected, the Indian approach has been that although you can encourage, you can educate, about birth control, they have not gone the Chinese route, which was absolute out coercion. The Chinese declared that you will have only one child, and they used various forms of coercion to insist upon it, and that has helped them get control over their population, but certainly at the expense of individual freedoms. We often will say, well, good for the Chinese, the Indians ought to do the same, and yet we would not even remotely suggest that those kinds of standards be applied in this country. When coercion was attempted in India in the mid-70s under the emergency, there was a tremendous reaction against it, and that was one of the reasons why Mrs. Gandhi got in trouble temporarily for a while.
The prediction is that India will pass Chinese as the most populous nation on Earth sometime early in the next century. India is over 800 million now and growing faster than China. China's about 1.1 billion. But India will be the most populous nation on Earth in the lifetime of many of us. It's also, I think, the most diverse nation, most diverse single national entity on Earth in terms of cultural and language and religious differences. You wonder if it can hold together. It's not at all homogeneous, whereas Bangladesh is quite homogeneous. It's about 85% Muslim, and they're all Bengals. Even the Christians there are Bengals. And the few Hindus, about 10 or 12%, are all Bengals, and they all speak the same language. India is extremely diverse and pluralistic, far more than the United States or Canada, I think. Do you agree, Paul?
Yeah, there's no place that's close. 16 official languages, about, if you count tribal languages, something close to 2,000 languages spoken. Religious diversity. Cuisine, dress, everything is amazing. Yes, Gertrude.
Did the South help begin Gandhi's idea of curriculum written, or was it going
on? The self-help?
Right.
Did you? Gandhi certainly was very important with that. He's not the only factor. There have been various revivalist movements, you could say Hindu revivalist movements even from the 19th century, which encouraged the same kind of thing, and analogous movements with some of the other communities as well. So it's a tradition that has been reinvigorated by Gandhi, but not necessarily original to him, I would say. Caste system changes, but it's strong and existed. In fact, one of the things that is, people think of the caste system as extremely rigid. Actually, it's one of the most flexible kinds of social structures that human beings have ever devised anywhere, which is the only possible explanation for its survival. That is, it's been able to adapt to all kinds of changes and conditions. Now, for example, one of the more modern uses of the caste system is that castes serve as effective lobbying groups in a pluralistic democratic system. Give you one concrete example, untouchability was outlawed in the Indian Constitution, but you have the category of ex-untouchables, or as they're known, the scheduled castes. There was an interesting court case that took place in India a few years ago in which a man sued to be declared an ex-untouchable because of the fact that certain kinds of quotas for educational entrance into universities, various other kinds of things, were set aside for these sort of like the reverse discrimination laws. And this was in part a result from the act of lobbying by this group to be able in various ways to enforce a political benefit to them. And so I used to live in Chicago for about 7 years, and you'd get this massive ballot when you voted, which would have all the judges and everything. I mean, you never had a clue as to what these people were worthy, but you noticed why they selected the names. There would be a Puchinsky, a Riley. I mean, there would be all the ethnic groups in Chicago had to be represented on the slate, and then that would assure that they would get elected. Likewise, caste names form the same function in any particular region where certain castes are dominant numerically. They maintain their strong caste identity as a way of using the system effectively to help their members out. The caste system is not dead in it by any means, but it changes and adapts. In the cities, a lot of the things that you associate with discrimination in the caste system are dead and gone, because the caste system works most effectively only if you know who everybody is and what their caste is. Then you can relate in proper ways. So in the villages, which are still 80% of India, it operates in a much more regular day-to-day fashion, but in the cities it means nothing in day-to-day contact with people.
Just in addition to that, the caste system is outlawed in modern India, but everybody you talk to says it still exists and people are still aware of it, much as racial discrimination is outlawed here, but we all know that it still exists. Two things. Not only are special government programs available for members of the outcast, but seats in Parliament are reserved. A block of seats by quota is reserved for people from the outcasts. And secondly, within the Christian community, we were told over and over again by Christians with great lament that even among Christians, consciousness of caste is still a present reality. And they shake their heads about that, they regret it, but I think, again, very much as with Christians here, racism is still a reality. So caste consciousness is there. A lot of the Christians in India who became converts in the early days of Christianity in India were from the outcasts. But there are also some high caste Christians. And the high caste Christians and the outcast or lower caste Christians know who each other is. And it has implications for church politics and things like that, and appointments. And they all regret it, but it continues to be a kind of a disease within even the Christian community. And I don't know, it's going to be a long while, I think, before awareness of caste dies out in India, even among Christians. Yeah.
I was wondering, going back to some of these overseas programs, the rural development programs, are they always connected to a local congregation or a local church body? And if not, you shook your head, what is the relationship, both officially and also in terms of the development?
It varies a great deal. In Bangladesh, the major Lutheran World Federation project is there with the leave of and the strong support of the government, the central government of Bangladesh. The small, tiny Lutheran church in Bangladesh has almost nothing to do with it. The Lutheran church in Bangladesh is about 6,000 baptized, you know, which is smaller than Mount Olivet Lutheran Church in Minneapolis, single congregation. It's a tiny church. In India, it's quite different. In India, all of the development work that is done by international church agencies is coordinated through CASA. Well, I don't know if all of it, the great bulk of it. CASA is the Church's Auxiliary for Social Action. It's a national ecumenical agency that has a staff and that works in all parts of the country in development, with most of the funding coming internationally. From Lutherans, Catholics, everybody. Europe, North America, Australia. And in India, it's a quite sophisticated system of Indian-controlled development efforts. In Bangladesh, it seemed to be very different. And I think partly that's a difference in the sophistication of the church structures in the two countries. There's a long history of ecumenical cooperation among Christians in India. In Bangladesh, it's very primitive. I mean, there just isn't much structure like that yet.
Then how does that relate to local congregation? I mean, do people look at those Christians in those countries and say, this is part of your system? Or is there a very big separation? Or do you know anything about that?
Well, most of the Christians in Bangladesh are down near the coast, traditionally, or in the capital city now because they've moved there. There is very little Christian presence of any tradition up in the northwest where the Lutheran work is. They're almost entirely Muslims there. And they say, we are not here to work among or to even work in the interests of any particular church. We're here to help people in need. And that's the test. Does it address the needs of human beings without regard to their religious affiliation or their potential religious affiliation? That is, they try to keep it clean so that it's not done as a subtle way of doing proselytization. If people turn to Christ as a result in the economy of God, fine, God be praised. But that is not the goal of development work. Development has its own integrity. It's an end in itself. And so they don't try, at least in those parts of the world, in my experience, they don't try to plant development work next to churches or where there are Christians so that churches will grow as a result. They go where the need is greatest or for whatever. In Bangladesh, they are located where they are because that's where the refugees were after the war. And they accompanied the refugees back to Bangladesh when they returned from India and then stayed with them. Now, in India, a lot of the Christian groups are a little bit upset because the development work isn't concentrating enough among poor Christians. They're saying, you're working among these non-Christians. Why don't you come and work among us? And it may be that the development agencies bend over backward not to seem to be favoring the Christian populations. But it's a very complicated and sticky question.
Yeah, and a couple of things that I just know anecdotally from personal experience or people who had those experiences. Part of the Indian tradition is taking care of your own. When Chuck mentioned this last point about Indian Christians feeling like they should be getting the lion's share of that, that's a cultural thing too. Mm-hmm. The notion of nepotism, for example, doesn't carry the same kind of negative connotations in India that it carries here. In fact, it's kind of an expected obligation if you're in a position of power that you take care of the people that you should be helping, which would include your very large extended family or fellow villagers or kinsmen or fellow religionists in this case. And some of this is literally a cross-cultural misunderstanding in which Indian Christian leaders feel they should have their hands on the money that comes in, and then that they should make many of the decisions about who gets what, and they have their own patronage networks, in other words. But that's part of the, some of the stress.
But at the same time, I guess I can understand that, but I also, on one side, but on the other side, you're very much limiting the possibility of those Christians reaching out to non-Christians, whether in service or anything, because it is so remote from that congregation. It's,
I guess, when you're talking about that.
Well, there are a couple things. I think the churches in doing development work want very much to avoid creating rice Christians. You know what rice Christians are. Christians who, I guess it comes out of Chinese missionary lore, but Christians who would become, people become Christians in order to get rice. That's the wrong motivation. Secondly, the governments in both India and Bangladesh make it very clear that if the church development agencies appear to be using development as a subterfuge in order to do undercover proselytization or evangelization, they'll be asked to leave. So they're very careful to keep a distinction, a division of labor within the church, and maybe go too far in that, but they're very careful about that. But on the positive side, let me mention two anecdotes from my visit there. In Bangladesh, I asked a Muslim who was working for the Lutheran Project, and most of the employees are not Christians because they employ local people and most of them are Muslim. I said, do the people here in these villages know who's doing this work? And he said, oh yes, they know that this is supported by international church money, people from abroad. The director of the agency is a Dane. But they know that these are church people. And I said, what does that mean to them? And he said, well, they know that while they probably aren't going to become Christians in the near future, they know, they have a good feeling about the Christian presence here because people see that they're working with the poorest of the poor. And they're apparently working with the poorest of the poor because that's a good thing to do for its own sake, not in order to make Christian believers of them. In India, in the area of the Comprehensive Rural Health Project, where the doctors Aroli, who are Christian doctors, are at work, they pointed to a cross on the clinic. And they said they didn't put that there. They're very low-key about the Christian witness. They're there to do health work. People know they're Christian. They respond. They have daily worship, daily matins for the whole staff and anybody who wants to come. But they don't push evangelization at people. They don't try to make converts overtly. And we said, well, who put the cross there? And they said a Hindu carpenter put that cross up when the clinic was built. And we asked the carpenter why, and the carpenter said, because the people of this village need to know why the Arolis have come here. The Arolis were Indian doctors who came from the Madras area across the subcontinent to another part. The Hindu carpenter knew why they had come. And he decided to put up a cross to witness to that. So the witness, I think, is being made. But it's quiet. It's not overt. It's not directed toward making converts immediately. But I think in the long-term economy of God, there will be evangelization happening. That's the way I view it. In the meantime, some of people's needs are being met, immediate needs here and now. Neighbors are being loved, and I think that's doing the gospel. Well, I think we are quitting by attrition. Let's call it here, and if any of you want to converse up here with Paul or myself, we'll be available. Thank you.